happened in this past week. On Wednesday morning at about 4 a.m., the new president of the United States was elected, Barack Obama. He won at the end of the polling by about 303 electoral votes to Mitt Romney's 206. The popular vote, even though it was a bit tight, and many people predicted that Romney was going to win the popular vote, but Bush will win the election, which would be a vindication for Al Gore and the Democratic Party in the 2000 election. Even though people predicted Romney would win the popular vote, it turned out in the end that Obama won by a very, very slight margin. Now the new head of state is facing, some would say, a divided America that many people supported Mitt Romney and really disliked Obama. And right now he is facing large opposition, especially in the House of Representatives, which is still Republican-dominated. In other news, Scotland's weather is looking mighty bright today. It's pretty sunny out. There's a few scattering clouds. In the morning, it was raining. It was kind of drizzling a little bit. But now it's actually a really, really nice day, turning out to be. It's actually a really great day for a Frappuccino. We're not supposed to sponsor anyone but the student union here, so I'm not going to say where I'm going to get the Frappuccino. But if you really do want a nice cold drink, or even a hot drink, or any kind of drink, or food, go to the student union restaurant, because it's a really good restaurant, and it's just amazing. Even if you're not in Scotland, just totally come over and visit that restaurant, because it's a great, you know, little bistro, bar kind of area. It's a great mood, very lively. And Sandra's back in, so I can stop rambling. Yay! Okay, can you hear from your headphones?
Yes, I can now.
All right.
Can you not?
I cannot hear from my
headphones. Try the other ones. Let me turn. Sorry about this.
Hello? All right, yeah, now I can hear.
Okay,
can hear.
Brilliant. Okay, we are actually going to start
Let me work this out.
Oh, God. For those of you who can't see, she's having trouble with wires and headphones and all kinds of stuff.
Some technical difficulties, but they are resolved now.
Yay.
Okay. Hello, my name is Tamar Ziv.
And my name is Sanjana Dalal.
And this is Outside the Bubble, your number one news source for everything that happens outside of St. Andrews.
This has been an intense and action-packed week. For the past 2 weeks, we had been giving you updates on the American election, yet all the poll data or survey percentage results in the world could have predicted the massive landslide of electoral votes in favor of Obama. 303 to Romney's meager 206.
I was up all night for that. It was absolutely mad. There were some hardcore Democrats with, you know, little Obama, vote Obama tattoos on their cheeks. There was one guy dressed completely in blue, carrying an American flag.
I had good intentions. But I tried to stay up.
But then it's okay. It's okay, though. You're
I'm British.
Yeah, exactly. You're not American.
Well, no, it technically does affect us, so I should have stayed up. But anyways, that sounds actually really crazy. But enough about old news. Today we plan to cover a region of the world, which I personally have a lot of fondness for, Africa.
Fondness? Why is that?
My dad grew up in Tanzania. And I also spent one summer in Zambia, in which I was helping a school there. It was called the Flying Angel School that my school from London had a long-term link with. And we went there for 2 weeks. We taught them. We made friends with all of them. Then when we had to leave, it was really, really sad. I still have the letters. There was one guy called Washington. And then he would always be like Washington, D.C. That was his full name. And then at the end of everything, he'd always be like, D.C. says bye. D.C. says hi.
Aw, that sounds adorable and like an incredibly unique experience.
Yeah.
But on to the news.
Yeah.
It seems that Ghana is experiencing some infrastructural problems currently. Just this Wednesday, a 5-story home goods store in the middle of Accra, the nation's capital, collapsed, killing 9 people and trapping dozens. A reported 51 people had to be sent to the hospital as a result. Officials blamed faulty structuring, considering that the building was only 9 months old.
Meanwhile, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has donated a $5 million grant to a Massachusetts non-profit group in all hopes of allaying the disturbingly high child mortality rate in Ghana. Experts agree that the health and safety of both mother and child could be exponentially improved if the birth took place at a hospital under the supervision of trained medical professionals. However, there is a cultural prejudice in Ghana against removing the pregnant woman from her abode during labor. However, the non-profit, called Project Fives Alives, a collaboration between the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and the National Catholic Health Services, has been operating in the country for about 4 years and has achieved substantial results.
The nonprofit is called Fives Alive because it aims to reduce the mortality rate of children under 5 in Ghana, which is one of the highest in Africa at 110 for every 1,000 live births. That's about over 10%. One of Ghana's Millennium Development Goals was to lower that rate, and Project Fives Alive aims to pull it down to at most 40 for every 1,000. The project utilizes a variety of methods to ensure that mothers and neonates receive care, mostly by urging the flourish and development of local and community health centers. It is aiding Ghana's Community Health and Planning Service, CHPS, to erect new clinics in various regions. One trio of medical health professionals in the Upper West region of Sibuli go above and beyond the call of duty and travel door to door to ensure that birthing women receive expert and immediate help during problematic births. It's actually quite amazing. Well, you know, while I was reading this article, there are these just three health professionals that give up their time and basically dedicate their lives to going door to door and helping these women and making sure that they get the proper care. Apparently, there was one story when they were all out of the clinic. There are only three workers in that clinic, in this clinic in Sibuli, and they were all out. And this woman had, you know, labor complications at 4 a.m. So her husband drove her to the clinic, and she ran there. There was no one there. It was completely empty. So they called, like they contact the personal phones of each of those workers, and the workers rushed back to the clinic and they saved the mother and the child.
Wow. Well, in Hamil, a similar program has been initiated, the Community Health Action Plan, or CHAP, as it's colloquially called, sponsored by the Japanese International Cooperation Agency and catalyzed by local community health officer Lazarus Gabel. This program brings together prominent members of the community, such as chiefs and health officials, as well as community health nurses, assemblymen, and volunteers who look over the regional healthcare system and identity flaws or shortcomings to be rectified. These meetings encourage independent internal preoccupation with health and well-being, which prompts national initiatives to improve conditions far from the aegis of foreign charity programs.
It is important that conditions for mothers and children are being ameliorated, and that right now this charity is actually helping to induce some kind of interest for internal aid so that it could run by itself, essentially, the healthcare programs. Now, happy song?
Yeah.
To reflect this positive development.
We're going
to
be playing...
And we're back. Now, on to more somber news, unfortunately. Mali has been in the throes of conflict since the beginning of this summer, when Islamic militants seized one of the most famous mosques in the historic city of Timbuktu on July 1st. The Ansar Dine group, which is rumored to be linked with Al-Qaeda, had taken control of the city earlier in the year and proceeded to destroy everything which did not rigorously comply with Islamic law. It targeted mainly mosques and mausoleums, and spokesman Sanda Old Bomana told BBC that the group had achieved its objective of destroying about 90% of tombs and shrines that did not subscribe to the strict implementation of Sharia law. According to Bomana, the Islamic code does not allow the building of tombs taller than 15 centimeters.
Ah, interesting. Timbuktu is a center of Islamic history and learning, known as the City of 333 Saints, which originated in the Sufi tradition of Islam. Its Sidi Yahya Mosque, the one damaged by the Ansar Dine group, is one of the most historically valued in the world, and some Timbuktu residents reportedly cried when they saw the internal destruction. Ansar Dine, a Salafi group, is religiously antagonistic to the veneration of saints and therefore do not consider the mosque legitimate or holy.
One of the mosque's famed religious landmarks is the Tomb of Saints, which the Ansar Dine completely desecrated in what a chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, called a war crime. UNESCO and the Mali government have issued orders for the group to halt its razing of sacred religious sites. But the orders are hollow. The Mali government lost significant legitimacy after a coup left the Mali army in disarray and facilitated the rise of the Ansar Dine group in April. The president was ousted. Concomitant to the rise of the Ansar Dine group was a takeover of northern Mali by the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, MNLA. Both are part of the Tuareg ethnic group, which is predominant in the northeast of Mali and in other regions in Central Africa, including parts of Algeria, Libya, and Niger. The Tuareg in Mali say that they are discriminated against for being light-skinned and neglected by the government. They prefer to call themselves the Kel Tamashek, or Speakers of Tamashek, their own language, which has its own alphabet.
The two main dissident rebel groups, Ansar Dine and the MNLA, jointly overtook Timbuktu. Although in general they have distinct aims, the MNLA wants autonomy for the Tuareg group, especially a state which is called Azawad for the Tuareg nation, while Ansar Dine wants to impose strict Sharia law across Mali. Ansar Dine has ties to the Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and there are rumors of jihadist fighters setting up training camps for rebels, but these are as yet unconfirmed. The Islamist group is reportedly much richer than the MNLA, having raised money through kidnapping Westerners for ransom and trafficking cocaine and hashish.
Under the control of these two often conflicting parties, Mali is in chaos. On September 9th, 16 Islamic preachers were killed at a security checkpoint en route to Bamako, Mali's capital. They were of the Dawa sect, which is not affiliated with the Islamists that control the northern Mali. The Mali government places blame on one rogue soldier, but considering the number of fatalities, a single shooter is unlikely. After the spring coup, the Malian army is nervous and very afraid of the jihadist takeover. It could be that, upon seeing Islamic preachers, the soldiers immediately assume them to be jihadists and open fire. Omar Old Hamaha, one of the Islamist leaders who have a stronghold in northern Mali, said he considered the killing of preachers from the Dawa movement a declaration of war by the Mali government.
Now, this past Monday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with the President of Algeria to discuss the deteriorating political situation in Mali. Algeria, just to the north of Mali, is in a strategic position to intervene in what is becoming a sanctuary for terrorists and Al-Qaeda militants. Algeria is one of the strongest militaries in the region and an active intelligence service, which will be used in efforts to oust the Islamic forces. The United Nations Security Council has already drafted a resolution stating that it is ready to send an intervening international force if requested by the Mali government. Both the Algerian and the American government stress the importance of reaching out to moderate members of the Tuareg community in order to perhaps issue a change from the inside and avoid unnecessary carnage. Still, it has been acknowledged, unfortunately, that action must take place soon, and counter-terrorism efforts are in process.
The global process of collective security and the customary anti-terrorist international law are being successfully implemented. Well, at least they're on their way. Now, after this quite, depressing news, but then again a bit hopeful at the end, here's another song.
Here's 1, 2, 3, 4 by Feist.
And we're back. In a reinforcement of the old adage that no news is good news, here is some not-so-good news from South Sudan. It seems that the nation country has expelled its United Nations Human Rights Officer after the head of the mission, Hale Johnson, submitted a report stating that the South Sudanese army had committed certain atrocities.
Ms. Johnson said in a statement that human rights monitoring must be protected. Human rights violations and discrimination were at the core of South Sudanese struggle during decades of civil war. And her report describes the violent abuses committed by the South Sudanese army in trying to disarm civilians after a bout of ethnic violence. After it was submitted, a human rights officer was given 48 hours to leave the country and is now in Uganda.
There is now growing international concern over the ability of the South Sudanese government to uphold civilian and human rights in the new country. South Sudan has historically been an area fraught with violence and ethnic conflict. Sorry, oh my God, I think I'm catching a cold. Anyway. After gaining autonomy, the violence abated, but a near-constant civil war has left large vestiges of unrest and continuing violence. So far, there have been numerous sexual assaults, tortures, and physical assaults of police trainees, as well as violence by a police officer against a UN human rights official last year. Just last week, South Sudanese police opened fire on secondary school students.
Whether or not the region stabilizes or further falls into chaos, it is only a question of time, unfortunately. But on to the next story. And this is looking at Rwanda and the bilateral relations between them and the UK, given recent events.
The International Development Select Committee, IDC, is today questioning Mitchell on his controversial decision to disburse £8 million of UK budget support to the government of Rwanda in his final hours as International Development Secretary and just 6 weeks after deciding to withhold this support, following allegations of Rwandan military backing for the M23 rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC.
Human Rights Watch has documented systematic human rights abuses by the M23 rebels in DRC over the last 6 months. The group is largely made up of soldiers who mutinied from the Congolese National Army in late March and May of 2012. Its senior commanders have a well-known history of serious abuses, and they include General Bosco, who was wanted on 2 arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and several other individuals involved in massacres and the recruitment of children to fight in eastern Congo.
Recent M23 abuses in eastern Congo include the deliberate killing of civilians, summary executions, and rape. Among the cases documented was that of an 8-year-old girl abused by M23 fighters. The M23 have also forcibly recruited civilians into their ranks and executed some who tried to flee. These abuses and those of other armed groups have contributed to the quickly deteriorating humanitarian situation in the region, with tens of thousands of people displaced by violence and fear.
Despite the Rwandan government's flat denials, Rwandan military support for the M23 has been significant throughout this period. This is the backdrop to Andrew Mitchell, who's a member of parliament and a former international democratic secretary. On the 4th of he announced on the 4th of September that he would release half the delayed 16 million of general budget support. He justified this on the basis that Rwanda had engaged constructively with the peace process initiated through the International Conference on the Great Lakes Nation. But Human Rights Watch has seen no evidence to support this positive assessment of Rwanda's role in Eastern DRC or of its constructive engagement to resolve the regional crisis. On the contrary, Rwandan military support to the M23 was ongoing from late July to early September, and that is throughout the period in which UK aid was withheld and then dispersed.
This neglect of rights concerns is no longer tenable. The new International Development Secretary, Justine Greening, should make the protection and advancement of human rights a much more central focus of DFID policy towards Rwanda. Human rights do feature in the text of a recently revised Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, signed by DFID and the Rwandan government. But rights principles in previous MOUs have been largely ignored. This needs to change. DFID should also do more to support Rwandan civil society, those courageous Rwandan men and women pressing for reform and respect for basic freedoms from within the country, often at great personal risk for themselves. It should also reassess the appropriateness of general budget support for Rwanda and ensure that aid for Rwanda's poorest citizens and support for poverty reduction and development does not inadvertently enrich authoritarianism or repression.
Well, yeah, clearly some serious issues will continue to develop over the few weeks. But, however, since this most would be speculative, we will refrain from comment. But now we're moving on to our next story, where we'll be looking at Morocco and the expulsion of 19 journalists from the Western Sahara for entering without permission. In a statement carried out by a state news agency, the ministry said that 15 Spanish and 4 Norwegian journalists had travelled to the regional capital to pretending to be tourists.
The journalists were reported to be planning to meet with the so-called separatist elements to commemorate the second anniversary of deadly clashes between police and local inhabitants. Morocco occupied and annexed the mineral-rich Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony, in 1975 after the Spanish withdrew.
The Polisario Front declared independence in 1976 on behalf of the inhabitants of the nomadic Sahrawi. The dispute is one of the world's longest unresolved conflicts. And it's an observer member of the Socialist International, and therefore the Polisario Front was outlawed in the Morocco-controlled part of West Sahara, and raising its flag is therefore illegal. The Polisario Front is also a successor of the 1950s and 1960s organization Movimento, the city of Villa Cineros. And since 1979, the Polisario Front has been recognized by the United Nations as a representative of the people of the Western Sahara, but it still remains a source of contention, obviously.
Enough history for one segment. We need a more lighthearted story now, I think. Given the American election happening this week, it is impossible to avoid the subject. We are going to share with you some of the international reactions to Obama's victory.
Yeah, so on the wall of the U.S. ambassador's residence in Pretoria, in South Africa, hangs a unique photo, a silhouette of Barack Obama bending to shake the hand of a smiling Nelson Mandela, who was sitting on a chair. And this was taken 7 years ago in Washington, and it documents the only meeting of America's and South Africa's first black presidents. And from dawn, the framed picture formed part of the backdrop to rolling election coverage at a champagne breakfast hosted by the U.S. Ambassador Donald Gibbs. There was little doubt who the South Africans present were rooting for. And as Mandela's ex-wife Winnie said, we need an Obama presidency. And she went on to say that Obama's victory speech brought tears to my eyes. So no doubt South Africa were very happy indeed to welcome Obama back.
Obama's victory was immensely popular across the continent, nowhere more so than Kogelo, the Kenyan village where his late father was born. Obama's step-grandmother, Mama Sarah, was quoted by the Daily Nation newspaper as saying, "Much as I must thank the American people for this gesture, victory is Africa's as it solidifies a position in our position in world leadership." The 90-year-old said there were many factors in Obama's triumph, but stressed two of them. "It is God's plan and, most of all, he is an outstanding gentleman."
The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, whose own election campaign borrowed conspicuously from Obama's, joined the chorus of congratulations. A government statement said, President Jonathan welcomes President Obama's victory in an intensely fought presidential race as an endorsement by the good people of the United States of his leadership. Progressive worldview and the very good work he has done in the past 4 years towards ending global economic depression and fostering global peace and security.
Zimbabwe was close behind alongside a host of other nations who congratulated Obama's secure victory through his landslide victory of electoral votes.
Yep, and we're now going to end with our last story of the day. And in Egypt, unfortunately, it's a sad story, but it's great that people are campaigning. So I guess it's quite an uplifting story.
Yeah.
So in Egypt, campaigners have taken to the streets during Eid to highlight the rising problem of women being attacked in public. After Nihal Said was traumatized in her experience of being harassed on the streets, she was determined to never let it happen again. And
the following week, she formed an anti-harassment group, inviting about 60 men and women via Facebook to gather on Mohammed Mahmoud Street near Tahrir Square to protest peacefully against harassment. Although they were met with resistance, they remained undeterred and set up a website to post her blogs detailing instances of harassment. By July, she says, the movement had begun.
The Free Egyptians Party recently called for constitutional changes to be made to end the phenomenon of sexual harassment in their country, a call that has apparently been answered by the Prime Minister, Hashan Kandil, who said earlier this month that stricter sexual harassment penalties were being drafted. Currently, there are 3 laws related to verbal insults, indecent behaviour and sexual assault, but rarely is an incident actually punished. And Omar El-Gabri, one of the growing number of men to join Basmal, the protesting group, said the laws are hard to enforce. They require women to have irrefutable evidence to prove a valid case.
And that is difficult. The position of women in Egyptian society came to the fore during the revolution when so many of them joined the protests on Tahrir Square. Professor Al-Ali has observed from his research that Egypt has a long history of feminist activity, but it was always active under the radar to avoid a political crackdown. What the events of 2011 did was allow those people to come forward and take a public stand against street harassment.
Nihal, the driving force of this movement, desperately would like to see a society that genuinely understands the greatness of women that they could achieve and the greatness of society that they could achieve if they were to actually empower women.
I think that this is a problem that many face. One of the charities that St. Andrew supports is one that I think works in Afghanistan and tries to essentially bring education to women by convincing the conservative men that if the women were given education and allowed to go to school, then they would make more money and they just would improve just the general lives of the family and the men. Unfortunately, due to religious constraints, custom, tradition, it's very, very hard to change the mindsets of certain people.
Yeah. Well, anyways, that is our time. Sorry about today.
It was a bit, you know.
Super, it was an interesting one.
Interesting day. Anyway, this is not going to happen again. We're going to start at 1 p.m. next Friday sharp.
And Myriad will be working.
Yeah, and everything will be working. And we're very, very sorry for the super condensed little, you know, news session. News at 1. News at 1:20. All right.
Yeah.
Please like us on Facebook for any updates. Outside the bubble on Facebook. And if you want to send a comment or an email, there is a BuzzFeed chat on standrewsradio.com.
Yep. So you go onto standrewsradio.com, you press the listen live button, and then a little Dropbox will come out, and then you can tell us
whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. You can tell us it's terrible if you really want to.
But, you know, it's
Please
not.
Please don't. So. Anyways, yeah, we're going to end with Waving Flag.